people. This is DJ Shy John, and I'm here to present the Kill Radio Weekly News Review. Let's start today with Harper's Weekly Review. This article was dated October 9th. Today is October the 11th. Harper's Weekly Review. Incumbent Democratic President Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney discussed domestic policy at the first presidential debate in Denver to prepare Obama, who said he was just okay at debating and that his opponent was a good debater, held a three-day debate camp at a Middle Eastern-themed hotel in Las Vegas. Romney ended his preparation by watching his sons play Jenga. Obama began the debate by wishing his wife a happy anniversary. There was some speculation as to whether this had an impact on my performance, he said later, responding to criticism that he had appeared sluggish and unfocused. But I did make it up to her on Saturday. When you get to 5,000 feet and you only have a few hours to adjust, said former Vice President Al Gore, I don't know, maybe. Romney was criticized for cutting off the debate moderator, PBS News anchor Jim Lehrer, and for suggesting he would cut federal funding to PBS if elected. I like PBS. I love Big Bird. Actually like you too, he said to Lehrer. You can kill things and still like them. Whew, said former GOP Senator Rick Santorum. You know who loves debates? Asked Big Bird. De fishes. Turkey shelled Syria after it fired a mortar into a Turkish border town and killed five Turks. Syrian rebels and security forces fought near the country's border with Lebanon, and car bombs exploded near a Syrian officers' club in downtown Aleppo. Hugo Chavez was elected to a fourth term as president of Venezuela. If Obama were from some neighborhood here in Caracas, he'd vote for Chavez, said Chavez. Officials in Pennsylvania and Mississippi temporarily blocked state laws requiring voters to present photo identification at election stations. Pennsylvania and Mississippi. Republican supporters questioned the legitimacy and timing of a U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics announcement that the unemployment rate had fallen below 8% for the first time since 2009. These Chicago guys will do anything. Can't debate, so change numbers, tweeted former General Electric CEO Jack Welch. I should have put a question mark on that, he later clarified. They're plotting and planning. Israel shot down an unmanned aircraft that it believed to be operated by Hezbollah. An anti-drone rally led by Pakistani politician and ex-cricketer Imran Khan was blocked from entering the province of South Waziristan and retired instead to tank. Opposition politicians in Iran blame President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad for hyperinflation related to the ongoing decline of the Iranian rial. If my presence is a burden to you, warned Ahmadinejad, I can write one line to say goodbye. Sounds like a threat. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were working to contain a meningitis outbreak caused by contaminated spinal steroid injections given to as many as 13,000 people in 23 U.S. states that has so far affected at least 105 people and killed 11. An 11-year-old Russian boy uncovered the nearly intact remains of a 30,000-year-old woolly mammoth on the Cape of Sapochnaya, Kharga. A pro-Kremlin youth group made a video for Vladimir Putin's 60th birthday set to Blueberry Hill that showed attractive young women riding on horseback, scoring in a hockey game against the United States, and retrieving an urn from the sea. Anti-Putin protesters brought reading glasses and tobacco pipes to a Let's Send Grandpa to Retirement rally near Moscow's Red Square. British Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm died at 95, and Bobby Hogg, the last native speaker of the Scottish dialect of Cromarty, died at 92. With silver in my pocket and oatmeal in my school, Hogg once was recorded singing, I'll tramp gladly homeward like codgers always do. a Cokeville, Oregon farmer whose hat, cigarette, dentures, and body parts were found in his pig pen was presumed eaten by his hogs. For all we know, it was a horrific accident, said Coos County District Attorney Paul Frazier, but it's so doggone weird. A recording was posted of Congressman Paul Brown, Republican of Georgia, who sits on the House's Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, claiming 2 weeks ago that evolution, embryology, and the Big Bang Theory were lies from the pit of hell. Let me back up there. That's a quote from Congressman Paul Brown, Republican of Georgia, who sits on the House's Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And he claimed 2 weeks ago that evolution, embryology, and the Big Bang Theory were lies from the pit of hell. What's he doing on that committee? Pope Benedict's former butler was convicted of leaking papal documents to a journalist and sentenced to 18 months house arrest. Moroccan warships prevented a Dutch abortion education boat from entering Smear Harbor. A veteran sued the U.S. government for improperly icing his penis, thereby necessitating a partial penectomy, and Connecticut's Supreme Court overturned a rape conviction after determining that the mentally handicapped victim could have repelled the assault at her Success Village condo by biting her attacker. The Connecticut Supreme Court overturned a rape conviction after determining that the mentally handicapped victim could have repelled the assault at her Success Village condo by biting her attacker. Oh my gosh. Al Newharth, the founder of USA Today, presented an Olive Garden reviewer in Grand Forks, North Dakota, with the 2012 Newharth Award for Excellence in the Media. A SpaceX Falcon launched a dragon into space. M&M's runoff was found to have changed the color of Alsatian honey. And Carmageddon 2 was declared a success in Los Angeles. Scientists were planning to save the world's coral reefs by poisoning starfish. A woman who had been spotted illegally riding a manatee near St. Petersburg, Florida, turned herself in. A New York City woman granted the right to die chose instead to live. Canadian police recovered 600 barrels of maple syrup, and Chicago police harvested and destroyed 1,500 tree-sized cannabis plants found near Stony Island Avenue. Now every plant, said the officer who spotted the marijuana from a helicopter, looks like dope to us. This is written by Ryan Liebenthal for Harpers.org. Now that we've gotten over the weekly review here, I just have a couple of articles I'd like to read to you. Now, one I found, I was at traffic court earlier this week when I should have been doing the news, and in a trash can I found a copy of the Korean Times dated October the 8th. And as a matter of fact, the only page printed in English was the op-ed page, so it gave me something to read in line. Actually, this was reprinted from the New York Times by Paul Krugman. Romney's sick joke. Number one, declared Mitt Romney in Wednesday's debate, pre-existing conditions are covered under my plan. No, they aren't, as Mr. Romney's own advisors have conceded in the past and did again after the debate. Was Mr. Romney lying? Well, either that or he was making what amounts to a sick joke. Either way, his attempt to deceive voters on this issue was the biggest of many misleading and or dishonest claims he made over the course of that hour and a half. Yes, President Obama did a notably bad job responding, but I'll leave the theater criticism to others and talk instead about the issue that should be at the heart of this election. So about that sick joke, what Mr. Romney actually proposes is that Americans with pre-existing conditions who already have health coverage be allowed to keep that coverage even if they lose their job, as long as they keep paying the premiums. As it happens, this is already the law of the land. but it's not what anyone in real life means by having a health plan that covers pre-existing conditions, because it applies only to those who manage to land a job with health insurance in the first place and are able to maintain their payments despite losing that job. Did I mention that the number of jobs that come with health insurance has been steadily declining over the past decade? What Mr. Romney did in the debate, in other words, was, at best, to play a word game with voters, pretending to offer something substantive for the uninsured while actually offering nothing. For all practical purposes, he simply lied about what his policy proposals would do. How many Americans would be left out in the cold under Mr. Romney's plan? One answer is 89 million. According to the nonpartisan Commonwealth Foundation, that's the number of Americans who lack the continuous coverage that would make them eligible for health insurance under Mr. Romney's empty promises. By the way, that's more than a third of the U.S. population under 65 years old. Another answer is 45 million. The estimated number of people who would have health insurance if Mr. Obama were reelected, but would lose it if Mr. Romney were to win. That estimate reflects two factors. First, Mr. Romney proposes repealing the Affordable Care Act, which means doing away with all the ways in which that law would help tens of millions of Americans who either have pre-existing conditions or can't afford health insurance for other reasons. Second, Mr. Romney is proposing drastic cuts in Medicaid, basically to save money that he could use to cut taxes on the wealthy, which would deny essential health care to millions more Americans. And no, despite what he has said, you can't get the care you need just by going to the emergency room. Wait, it gets worse. The true number of victims from Mr. Romney's health proposals would be much larger than either of these numbers for a couple of reasons. One is that Medicaid doesn't just provide health care to Americans too young for Medicare. It also pays for nursing care and other necessities for many older Americans. Also, many Americans have health insurance but live under the continual threat of losing it. Obamacare would eliminate this threat, but if Mr. Romney would bring it back and make it worse. But Mr. Romney would bring it back and make it worse. Safety nets don't just help people who actually fall. They make life more secure for everyone who might fall. But Mr. Romney would take that security away, not just on health care, but across the board. What about the claim made by a Romney advisor after the debate that states could step in to guarantee coverage for pre-existing conditions? That's nonsense on many levels. For one thing, Mr. Romney wants to eliminate restrictions on interstate insurance sales, depriving states of regulatory power. Furthermore, if all you do is require that insurance companies cover everyone, healthy people will wait until they're sick to sign up, leading to sky-high premiums. So you need to couple regulations on insurers with a requirement that everyone have insurance. And to make that feasible, you have to offer insurance subsidies to lower-income Americans, which have to be paid for at a federal level. And what you end up with is precisely the health reform President Obama signed into law. One could wish that Mr. Obama had made this point effectively in the debate. He had every right to jump in and say, "There you go again." Not only was Mr. Romney's claim fundamentally dishonest, it has already been extensively debunked, and the Romney campaign itself has admitted that it's false. For whatever reason, the president didn't do that on health care or on anything else. But as I said, never mind the theater criticism. The fact is that Mr. Romney tried to mislead the public, and he shouldn't be allowed to get away with it. And I agree. And keep in mind, people, those of you listening live, that tonight is the vice presidential debate, and it starts at 6 p.m. Now, I have one final article here for you. It's of great interest, kind of to celebrate Columbus Day, which was this past Monday. This is from Zocalo. The column is called Nexus, and it says, "Someone get Columbus a better publicist. His reputation hasn't been this bad since the 1490s, and we have the textbooks to prove it." By Rebecca Schaefer. "During my 3 years as a teacher at low-income schools in Washington, D.C., my students read about Sojourner Truth Abraham Lincoln, Cesar Chavez, and other famous Americans, but we never studied Christopher Columbus. The first school where I worked did not observe the holiday, and the second treated it as parent-teacher conference day. So much for understanding the namesake of the District of Columbia. For most of American history, right back to the first Columbus Day celebration in New York in 1792, neglecting Columbus would have been unthinkable. My father grew up in Columbus, Ohio, where the explorer was idolized, second to only the local Big Ten football coach. In the U.S. Capitol building, near where I live in Washington, a 17-foot-tall bronze rotunda is dedicated to Columbus with 9 panels depicting the glories of his life. When I was a kid in school, Christopher Columbus was a heroic legend like Johnny Appleseed, Davy Crockett, or even the first astronauts. Then the story changed. Today, so many people revile Christopher Columbus that 3 states, Hawaii, Alaska, and South Dakota, do not even observe Columbus Day. In Berkeley, California, the holiday is instead called Indigenous Peoples Day. So I thought I'd take a look at how school textbooks have treated the genuine explorer over time to see how Columbus went from hero to villain. Does Chris Columbus need a PR specialist in crisis management? The heroic depictions of Columbus began not with textbooks, but with a best-selling biography, Washington Irving's The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus, published in 1828. It celebrated Columbus as visionary and extraordinary, responsible for nations and tongues and languages which were to fill the lands he discovered. Irving's version of Columbus was disseminated through the McGuffey Readers, a series of schoolbooks that were a staple in 19th century classrooms. From their first publication in 1836 until 1920, they sold over 122 million copies. Their author, William Holmes McGuffey, used selected texts from renowned writers to deliver strong, moralistic, and patriotic messages. For a description of Columbus, McGuffey chose an excerpt from Irving, who makes the explorer sound like the type of man my mother would want me to marry. Columbus's ambition was lofty and noble, inspiring him with high thoughts and an anxiety to distinguish himself by great achievements. His conduct was characterized by the grandeur of his views and the magnanimity of his spirit. Instead of ravaging the newly found countries like many of his contemporary discoverers who were intent only on immediate gain, he regarded them with the eyes of a legislator. He sought to colonize and cultivate them, to civilize the natives, to build control of law, order, and religion, and thus to found regular and prosperous empires. That he failed in this was the fault of the dissolute rabble, which it was his misfortune to command, with whom all law was tyranny and all order was oppression. Sounds like Americans. 19th century Americans would also read a laudatory account of Columbus in Elements of Useful Knowledge, a book by Noah Webster of dictionary fame. In Haiti, he landed, entered into a friendly intercourse with the natives, built a fort in which he left a garrison of 38 men with orders to treat the natives with kindness, and sailed for Europe. Webster wrote, "That Columbus died, neglected by his country, was a misfortune Webster blamed on the jealousy of others." In 1887, a book called The Adventures of Columbus, Early American History for Children, portrayed a Columbus who would have felt right at home in Mark Twain's The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, which was published 9 years earlier. The Adventures of Columbus described its hero as a mere lad, busy with thoughts concerning that unknown land. The natives who Columbus encountered were supposedly just as childish, saying, "These wonderful beings have brought their thunder and lightning from the skies and will protect us." A less fanciful depiction of Columbus appeared in David Muzzy's textbook, An American History, first published in 1911 and considered one of the premier textbooks through the 1950s, while it read in part like an adventure story, with Columbus and his crews worrying about horrible monsters might be awaiting to engulf them and facing the Odyssean fear that they might never get home again. An American History also examined Columbus's final years of incarceration and penury, so passed away in misery and obscurity, a man whose service to mankind was beyond calculation, Muzzy lamented. The first major blow to Columbus came in 1980, when historian and activist Howard Zinn released A People's History of the United States. Zinn's book told the story of an egalitarian and harmonious community of Native Americans who were enslaved and killed by Columbus, forced into hard labor and a search for gold that did not exist. Columbus had been responsible for a genocide of millions of natives and murder in the name of progress. Today, contemporary textbook publisher McGraw-Hill offers a slightly less damning depiction of Columbus, but only slightly. On one of its websites, McGraw-Hill plays up the thrill of discovery, but also stresses greed and ruthlessness, the enslavement, torture, murder, and extermination of the native people of the West Indies followed quickly on the heels of Columbus and his men. This is in keeping with textbook trends. According to University of Michigan study, history textbooks in recent years show a strong trend of portraying Indians more positively and placing Columbus on a more complex positive-negative trajectory. In short, Columbus seems to have gone from all good to all evil. As I see it, the result is a caricature-like, ahistorical understanding of the past. Not to mention colorless, many of the histories leave out some of the most intriguing aspects of his 1492 saga, like the fact that Columbus, for all his determination and vision, made a colossal mistake in believing, until the day he died, that he'd reached Asia, or that, undeterred by shipwrecks, disease, and a return trip to Europe in shackles, he actually made four separate voyages to the New World. Now that's a lesson I could have taught my class. Take big risks, embrace serendipity, and celebrate some of your more interesting mistakes. Just don't go forth and enslave. Rebecca Schaefer, a 2009 Teach for America Corps member, is a program associate at the New America Foundation. Well, and I guess that's the news for today, people. And that, ladies and gentlemen, wraps up this week's news. Thank you to all of my contributors, and thank you for, harpers.org. Have a good week, be good to each other, and stay the heck out of the news. All right.